to have to recognize that God is in that and kind of adjust to it. And Phil's friend and the tragic violence. Well, we have to realize that somehow, some way, God is kind of in that. Evil doesn't really exist because God is equally in everything. Tornado, God is equally in that as God is in a sunny day. And so they believe that because God was kind of in everything, that, you know, what we experience as evil and what we experience as good, it was really all a harmony. It was really all just part of kind of this giant, I don't know, this giant ecosystem. And if we think about the ecosystem and we think about, say, a hawk eating a rodent. Okay, well, that's just the balance of nature. The hawk needs to eat. There's too many rodents. And so the way that nature takes care of too many rodents is it has the hawk and it eats the rodent. And it's all good except unless you're the slow rodent. But everything is kind of in balance. Okay, and that's Stoicism. And again, it really doesn't offer much in the way of hope. It's kind of like just get adjusted. And so the way we hear Stoicism talked about today is, oh, that person's rather stoic. They don't show any emotion. Well, there's no need to show emotion because nothing's really bad and nothing's really good. And so we don't get too high, we don't get too low, we just kind of stay stoic. This is all just part of the system. God is in everything. Everything just kind of works out. And meanwhile, there's not really any hope because we know deep down inside that a murder is a murder and that's evil. And we know deep down inside that we weren't created to die by MS. We were created to live. And so you had the Epicureans and you had the Stoics in both trying to figure out kind of the best way to approach life. And one saying the gods aren't involved, just make the most of it. And the other saying, no, the gods are in everything. And so nothing's really evil and nothing's really good. It just is. And our best approach is to just kind of be well adjusted. Then you had the rest of the folks. And the Stoics and the Epicureans, they didn't really believe that there was much point to worshiping idols, but they went ahead and went along for the ride because usually there was good food. But the rest of the culture really believed in idols. And let me back it up this way. What they had a tendency to do was deify everything that they valued. So if they value love, they're going to make a love goddess. If they value victory, they're going to turn victory into a god. If they value strength, then they're going to turn strength into a god and make an idol of strength. If they value prosperity, then they are going to create kind of a god of prosperity, make an idol to that and worship that. So in their idolatry, yes, they are worshiping things that don't give life, things that they have made, but those things that they have made are really, in some sense, just a projection of the things that they value, the things that they want to be. In one sense, we don't do that. In another sense, we do that in countless ways. One of the things that we worship and have turned into an idol, something that we value and we've kind of deified it, is youth or youthfulness. So one way that you know that we've done this is you flip through the channels watching the news. How many old people do you see giving the news? Everybody looks about the same, right? It's been fascinating to kind of watch KUSI. I don't know if you watch KUSI, but they had the oldest guy ever on the news, right? John Coleman. Thank you, Migo. So he's the old guy, right? He's ancient of days. And he retires. Who did they replace him with? Well, they started out with Leslie Lopez. And so a young woman, to see if that will keep people watching. And I don't know what happened, but now they got another guy, and he's a young guy. They didn't replace the old guy with an old guy. They went young. Because their thinking is that we worship youth. And so if they have a young guy up there, there's a greater likelihood that we're going to worship, you know, somebody who looks young and somebody who looks attractive and somebody who has energy, somebody who has everything that we value, that will watch that person. John Coleman, he was kind of an anomaly. He would never get hired today. I don't know how he got hired in the first place, but he was good. But anyways, so we do this kind of a thing that was happening in Athens, where maybe we don't erect a statue, but we will erect gods in one fashion or another that kind of portray what we value and what we aspire to be. So in the midst of this culture, where you have the Stoics and the Epicureans, and then you have all the others who are kind of idolizing various attributes that they value, here is Paul preaching Jesus and the resurrection. Now, he gets kind of called on it before the Areopagus. I'll learn how to say that sooner or later. But this is kind of the council, if you will, the city council or the thought police of Athens. And you kind of say, wait a minute, I thought Athens, they valued new ideas and all of that stuff. What would they be doing having kind of thought police? Well, they were very concerned about what was kind of taught and spoken about. And so anybody who kind of came into town with kind of a new teaching or a new idea, they had to present that teaching to this council. And if this council saw that that teaching was kind of detrimental to the culture of Athens, then they would forbid that person to teach, and they'd get him out of town. And so Paul has been teaching in the synagogue, and he's in these dialogues at the Agora, and the Areopagus people hear about it, and they say, okay, you got to come make your case to us, and we'll decide if you can stay and keep on with this teaching or if you got to go. If this teaching is a threat to kind of life in Athens, or if we'll go ahead and let you stay. Now, realize the Jews are already present. And so you don't have to be kind of a pluralist to be in Athens. It's okay to worship one God, but they're concerned about what Paul is saying about Jesus, what Paul is saying about the resurrection. So Paul begins to lay it out for them. And he lets them know that in one sense or another that they're ignorant. And they know their ignorance. That they have a idol, a statue, a monument to an unknown God. And Paul says, the God that you're ignorant about, that's who I'm going to talk to you about. That's who I will make known to you. And it's God the Creator. It's Israel's God. It's God the Creator. And he talks about how God created everything. The heavens, the earth, the fullness therein. That God is the author of it, the creator of it, the sole creator of it. That all these other gods that you worship, you know, you're very religious people, and I'll give you credit for that. But there's one God who created it all. And it's in that God that we have life. It's in that God that we live and we move and we have our being. That God is the source of who we are, not these other gods. So far, he's just a good Jew. But eventually, he's going to talk to him about Jesus and about the resurrection. And this is what blows their mind. What Paul is saying is that his God, this God that is unknown to them, this God that they are ignorant of. What Paul is saying is that this God who created everything is not walled off up above, but he's actually engaged in lives, in history. In fact, this God who created everything is actually responsible for the movements of history, the movements of people across time and across places, the rising and falling, that this God is responsible for all that. And that this God has entered into history in the person of Jesus himself and has taken on the burden of humanity, the burden of sin, the burden of death. And in taking death upon himself in the person of Jesus, God raised Jesus up from the dead. And everybody is going to have to give an account to this man, Jesus, whom God raised from the dead. So here's they hear that and they respond in different ways, and some believe and some say, wow, that really is a new idea. And Dionysius, one of the leaders on the council, he becomes a believer. Damarius, she becomes a believer. Others believe. Here's what I'm thinking about with it. The hope of the resurrection. That we don't need to tell Phil's friend, just adjust. Just adjust. That it's really not evil, it's just part of how things are, and you just got to adjust to how things are. And God's in everything. And, you know, just kind of meditate and just kind of breathe out and exhale, and God's in everything. And just adjust. No. That's just kind of in denial of the pain of evil. We never have to deny the painfulness and the wickedness of evil. We never have to tell ourselves just be happy. We never have to tell ourselves just have a good attitude. And like the Epicureans, they'd be telling, you know, Sister Lynn and Denise before she passed that, you know, you just got to make the most of it. That just make the most of it, and eventually you'll die and you'll be released from this pain. That just make the most of it, and yeah, life isn't very fair, but don't overindulge and just kind of live in moderation, and you know, eventually you'll die and you'll kind of be free of this unfairness. And so, I mean, so often those are the voices that we hear. So often that's the world's approach, is to, you know, just make the best of it. If you're having a hard time making the best of it, take these. Or we end up almost kind of celebrating death as if we finally get out of here. That death is just, well, I'm glad that's over, you know? And that becomes our approach, and that's hopelessness. And that's it's a tragic thing when we slip into such hopelessness. And then, you know, well, we'll worship this attribute or that attribute. No. We have hope because Jesus is risen. God comes into the world that God created in the person of Jesus to save and redeem the world. Not to just get our spirits out of here, but to actually redeem every aspect of it. All of the brokenness, all of the hurt, all of the sickness, to cure all of the violence. That's our hope. And that's what God has done in Jesus. And so the hope of Phil's friend is the resurrection. The death will not ultimately separate. The violence will not ultimately be victorious. That's the hope of Denise. That's the hope of Sister Lynn. That, yeah, MS was a part of this fallen world, but good news, God's not just up there above doing God's stuff, that God is actually here working in redemptive ways. And that sickness is sickness. We don't have to pretend that somehow it's good and it's balanced. It's sickness. We don't have to pretend. And we can grieve and we can cry out, and we cry out with hope that Jesus is risen. And with Jesus being risen, there is hope, not simply that Denise will get out of this body, But there is hope that this body will be redeemed and restored and be made new. So, maybe one other aspect to tie into. So often, the Greeks, so often us, because we got frustrated with physical life and the painfulness of physical life, we just gave up on physical life. And it just became all about the spirit, all about the soul. And we just saw, you know, they would celebrate kind of the immortality of the soul. And they saw matter as evil, matter as kind of corrupt. It's the soul that's good, it's the body that's bad. But that's not the God of Scripture. That's not the God of Christianity. When God created the heavens and the earth and the fullness therein, and God created us male and female, and God saw all that God had made, and God saw that it was very good. And when God raised Jesus from the dead, he didn't just raise up a ghost. He didn't leave that old wretched body there in the tomb and have Jesus passing around, you know, moving around in ghostly form. That body was raised and was victorious over death. That is our Christian hope. We value the material world and we take seriously the pain and the violence and the affliction. But our hope is not escape. Our hope is redemption. And the cross, Jesus bears the pain of this broken world and all of its sinfulness, all of our sinfulness. And in the resurrection, God raises him up victorious to give new life. Jesus is risen, and he's the first fruits. In our hope, the good news is that promise that as we believe and trust in Jesus, we will participate in that resurrection. Denise will be raised up. Phil's friends, his children, will be raised up. Monica's father, raised up. And you can think of the people in your lives where it seemed that death won and we just have to adjust. No, we don't just have to adjust. We hold fast to the hope that we have in Christ. I invite you to stand with me and to receive communion. We receive the life of the one who gave himself and who was raised, that we might participate in that self-giving, in that recognition of how evil evil is, and that we also might be empowered by his resurrection to live into that hope of this day that Christ is bringing. So I invite you to stand if you are one of the Lord's disciples, if you desire to have his life in you. I invite you to come and receive the bread, receive the cup, and we'll take communion together. And Kat, if you want to come, and Angela, and Rebecca, and Melissa, and Rodney, and John Mark.